You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Elaine Kmark. I'm a senior fellow here at Brookings and the director of the Center for Effective Public Management. Welcome to this forum today, or this discussion today, with some truly smart people on the presidential primaries. We are one day before the South Carolina primary for the Democrats, and we are 4 days before Super Tuesday, the first really big contest in this race. I know it probably seems like this race has been going on forever, but the fact of the matter is that on next Tuesday, it really begins in earnest. So far, only a minuscule portion of the delegates in either party have been allocated to presidential candidates. And some people may not know this, but there actually aren't any delegates yet. There aren't any real people yet who are delegates. There's only allocations. There's only awards. So we know that at some point down the road in Iowa, Donald Trump will get a certain number of delegates, but we don't know who they are. So bear that in mind. We are allocating delegates, but we actually don't have real people. This is important because I think one of the things that's probably going to come up today is whether or not we have a brokered convention. So we're on the precipice of really finding out where this race is going. And we've got some fabulous people here to talk to us about this. To my immediate left is Anna Greenberg, Senior Vice President of the Greenberg Quinlan Rosner Research Group. They are a long-standing company in Washington who's been involved in many, many congressional races. Anna was also on the faculty with me at the Harvard Kennedy School not too many years ago. 15 years ago. So it's great.
Not too many.
I was a teenager then. Not in my life. To her left is David Yepsen. He's now the director of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. And, of course, many of us know him as the premier political reporter for the Des Moines Register for many years, all the fountain of all wisdom about Iowa and presidential politics. To his left is Amy Walter, national editor of the Cook Political Report, one of the most respected political reports out there, and Amy has brought a new energy to the place, and we're pleased to have her here. And then on the very end, we have Juan Williams, political analyst of Fox News. You see him often on television. He is also the author of a fantastic book, which I would recommend to you, called Muzzled, The Assault on Honest Debate. So we've got quite a crowd for you this morning, and I'm just going to open it up with a quick question to each of our panelists, and then we will have a little discussion, and then we'll quickly get to your questions as in about 20, 25 minutes. Let me start with Juan, okay? I thought that one of the best lines from this morning was from Marco Rubio, who said, "We are not going to turn over the conservative movement to a con artist." What happened last night, and did it matter? Will it matter on Super Tuesday?
Good morning to everyone. I thought Marco Rubio had a great night last night on the political stage. Finally, he brought the fight to Donald Trump, but it's a matter, and I think, Elaine, your question suggests this, of is it too little too late? Has the horse already left the barn here? And is it possible at this point to try and mute the Trump effect? And the Trump effect is such, and I think the best quote of the morning, Elaine, is not anything from Marco Rubio, but came from Senator Lindsey Graham, who said the Republican Party has gone, I believe, bat blank crazy. Is that right? Is that
yes.
The quote?
That was from last night.
That's from last night.
Yeah.
But it's all over this morning. Yeah. even on Fox News, that the Republican Party, in the opinion of a stalwart Republican leader, is no longer really the party that he knows. So to my mind, the question then becomes, are we living sort of in the age of Trump, and is Trump now in charge of the Republican Party? And on so many levels, I think that's true. I think the place I would start is to say that when you see Trump challenged last night in the debate, he's challenged on basic Republican policies. And the question is, are you a Republican, Mr. Trump? Are you in line with Republican policies, for example, with regard to free trade? Answer, no. Are you in line with Republican policies as advocated by Speaker Paul Ryan? And, of course, when it comes to issues such as cutting Medicare, Social Security to take care of the debt, answer from Mr. Trump, no. And on and on. You know, what are you going to do about Obamacare? He says, oh, I'm not going to repeal it. I'm going to get rid of it, but then I'm going to put in place something much better. Well, what is that? And then
beautiful.
Beautiful?
Beautiful.
Oh, I like
it. It's beautiful.
It's going to be beautiful. Yeah. But I don't know if it's going to be Republican, Amy. That's the thing. I don't know. But I would say this in short, Elaine, that after New Hampshire, South Carolina, Nevada, and going into Super Tuesday, I think the Republican Party is now the party of Trump. I think we're living in the age of Trump. I don't think it's possible to see Donald Trump challenge President Bush on weapons of mass destruction in clear contravention of Republican thought on this issue and say the man was a liar, say the president was a liar, and have no effect on his political prospects. He just, not only does he survive what others would see as a fatal misstep, he thrives. He is continuing to thrive and to grow. I am often reading these days that he is something of a new age Andrew Jackson, back in the early 1800s, the outsider president. I've seen people refer to him as William Jennings Bryan, who spoke up for the poor American farmers as victims of Wall Street. Some people like the idea of the businessman, the Henry Ford. Ford was anti-Semitic in the way that Trump is anti-immigrant. But the most recent analogous figures in my political lifetime would be Ross Perot, who talked about that giant sucking sound taking jobs across the border down south, or Pat Buchanan, who also appealed to sort of white working class anxiety and discontent and talked about his pitchfork brigade. The one typically, you know, these kinds of populist angry movements do not end up with someone taking residence on Pennsylvania Avenue. The one exception I would point out, though, would be, I think that in the aftermath of the Great Depression, FDR, with help from some unlikely characters, you know, Father Coughlin, who was taking control of the radio at that time, really had a strong populist message that became the New Deal, that became an effort to speak against Wall Street, to speak against the banks, even speak against the Supreme Court, and say that the system was rigged and that he spoke for the people. And in so many ways, of course, FDR remade the Democratic Party of that era. I think that the Democratic Party today is still pretty much in his image. And Trump is right now transforming the Republican Party. It's just that at this early stage, it's hard to say, is he remaking it for all time?
Thank you. That was great, including the history. Thank you. Amy, continuing on this same theme, what is it that you know about Trump now that you didn't know when this began?
Okay, well, thank you again for having us. Here's the thing that has struck me the most about Donald Trump and this entire campaign. I've been covering campaigns for a long time. And what's the most unique about this isn't just the fact that you have a, you know, reality show person dominating the discussion, but I've been most struck by how flat-footed his opponents and the media have been to his rise. And again, campaigns aren't really particularly complicated. Your job is to define yourself and define your opponent before they do it to you. There we go. That's how you run a campaign. We started this campaign and we saw Donald Trump's numbers in a terrible place. He was already defined. He had 100% name recognition and he was seen very unfavorably, even among Republicans. I think it started when we started seeing polls first come out in this race when he announced back in June. 60, 65% of Republicans thought negatively of him. So, of course, we didn't take him seriously as a candidate. The other candidates didn't take him seriously. He's 65% negative and 100% name ID. That's called you're not going anywhere, right? But then his numbers started to go as he became a candidate and started saying things people liked and people were attracted to him. His numbers started to turn around. And even as his numbers started to move up, nobody reacted. Again, and if we're running the campaign, this were a House race, a Senate race, any other race, you say, gosh, your opponent who is a billionaire, who's getting a lot of airtime, whose numbers are now starting to turn around, we should probably stop that. Mm-hmm. We should probably go on the attack. We should probably, I don't know, dump out the 400,000 pages of opposition research there is on this person and the many, many outrageous things he said and done. But they didn't, because it was, oh, we got to fight our lane. We got to win our lane. Then we're going to go after him. He can't win, so we're going to win the establishment vote. I'm going to win the conservative evangelical vote, and then we'll be one-on-one with Donald Trump. Well, the entire time, Donald Trump continued to make the race in his image. I agree with Juan, which is he has made them react to him. And what's remarkable to me is that they let this happen. And, I'm not running. It's easy for me to be in the bleachers and yelling out onto the field. But the very first focus groups I sat in with Republicans thinking about Donald Trump, or actually, let's say this, thinking about this race, two things were very clear. One, Jeb Bush was not going to be the nominee. He went into this race, much like Donald Trump, with perceptions about him that were already pretty hardened. This is not the candidate that voters were looking for. In fact, in the very first focus group we sat in that Peter Hart did in October of 2015, Republican candidates, when asked who they liked, just looking around, like of all the politicians, who would you like to see as president? These are Republicans. They picked Rand Paul and Elizabeth Warren. Okay? Republicans, Elizabeth Warren. And that goes to Juan's point about the populace, but I think it also went, they didn't even know their policies. They just knew they were different, and they seemed to be authentic. And whatever it was that they're saying, they don't know really what it is, but they seem to believe it. So you could see the seeds sown then for somebody like Trump. You could also see why Bush and his profile were going to be problematic. But as we moved through this process and Trump started to get more popular, the one thing that kept coming up for voters was, I just don't know that he has the temperament to be president. Like, we like what he says, and it's kind of funny, and we believe him. But finger on the button? Unifier? Instead, what Republicans did as the way to attack him was, well, he's not a real conservative. Well, he doesn't really believe this. That's okay. But nobody really believes you either, because you're a politician. So it doesn't matter. You're the worst messenger of that. So instead of going after the temperament issue, like, again, we're talking about president. Let's go to the temperament. Let's go to the ways in which he hasn't helped the little people. Let's go to the ways in which his business failures have hurt regular people like you. They went after abortion, the traditional. Again, they ran and were like, well, let's do the traditional conservative issues. That's not enough. And I agree that it may be too late. Maybe it's not. I mean, the thing I've long thought about Trump was that he had a very solid floor, 25%. Of Republican voters, there was nothing you could do to dissuade them. And he was right when he said, I could walk down Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and people would vote for me. It's true. 25% of voters were never going anywhere. There's nothing you could say to dissuade them. But there were 75% looking for another alternative, and the other candidates didn't provide that alternative. So as he starts winning, those voters say, well, I don't know, he's a winner. I like winners. Let's get on the bandwagon. The question from this debate is whether that he, meaning Marco Rubio, can stop the bandwagoners. Not that he's going to make Trump collapse, not that he's going to lose that 25-30% that are with him, but whether they can stop the rest of those voters who right now are sitting at Cruz, Rubio, undecided, and move over to him. And the only way we're going to know the answer to your question about what mattered is it's as much March 1st, but really much more on the 8th in Michigan and the 15th in Illinois and Ohio and Florida.
Right. One of the things just to add for our viewers and those in the audience who might not know is that come March 15th, the Republican Party allows for winner-take-all primaries. Right. So March 15th is a big day to watch because if it's still a multi-candidate field, the winner, even a plurality winner, could really rack up a lot of delegates. David, I wanted to go to you and ask you. You spent many, many years in the first in the nation contest in Iowa, and the early primaries and caucuses are, you know, usually that what they do is they clear the field a little bit. Can you talk about how that has or hasn't happened this time? Because a lot of people think that, gee, Trump wouldn't be doing so well if there was only one other person in the race.
Well, I think the early states have cleared the field. There's a lot of candidates who have dropped out. So I think part of the traditional role of these early states to winnow the field of candidate of weak candidates and also to elevate some candidates out of obscurity, that process has happened. It's just such a large field. The second thing, though, is I think the great winnower of this, unfortunately, has been polls, because the important events of this campaign have been the debates. The decision of who got into which debate was made by polls and networks. And when you have a celebrity candidate like a Donald Trump, that automatically elevated him to the head of that pack of candidates. So I think the effect of the use of polls, and all of us here, and especially know the limitation of polls, did sort of supplant the role of grassroots voters looking at candidates and then rendering a judgment. Did the debate last night have an effect? Yes, I think it did. And I think we should remember how late a lot of this is breaking. Maybe you can speak to some of this, how many late deciders there are. And there are people who watch that and who will react to that. And it's not particularly, we think of millennial voters, if they're paying attention at all. I see it in my students. They aren't very engaged, but then they get real engaged at the end. So I think that is still a question yet to be played out. I'm not quite as I don't think it's over with yet. Mm-hmm. And I'll just conclude by this. One of my favorite movies is the movie Bridge on the River Kwai. And 1957, Alec Guinness plays the British colonel who builds the Japanese a bridge. And at the very end of the movie, you'll recall he says, "Oh, my God, what have I done?" And I have a feeling the Republicans have got to have that Alec Guinness moment here, and it may come here in the next few weeks.
Oh, goodness. Thank you. Anna, there's a lot of other races going to happen this year, okay? Congressional races, Senate races, gubernatorial races. We're not hearing anything about them. I mean, this presidential race seems to have sucked the air out of everything. Talk to us a little bit about the other races and about the potential impact of the presidential race on those races.
Thanks. I actually want to follow up on a couple things that David and Amy said. When we talk about Trump and sort of his rise and not being challenged and the race being defined by him, you left out the media. So you talk about the Republican candidates and then you talk about polls, but polls are not just organic entities on their own. They're used by some people to do something. In this case, I'll give you an example. CNN, an early debate at CNN, they changed the criteria for the percentage that candidates have had in order to get Carly Fiorina into the debate, and then ask questions of Carly Fiorina about Trump and what he said about women, and then Carly Fiorina got a bump for 3 days after that. That was completely manufactured by CNN. So there's a complicitness on the part of the media in sort of helping elevate him. I think he's gotten an unprecedented amount of free airtime. I think people have calculated how many dollars that would be. So I just want to make sure we don't leave the media out as being complicit in the rise of Donald Trump. But, yes, you're right. There are a lot of other races. There is a good chance that Democrats can take back the Senate, which is a big deal if there's no Supreme Court nominee, for example, until the next president is elected. There are competitive races in Pennsylvania, New Hampshire, Illinois, Wisconsin, possibly Ohio. It depends a lot on what happens at the top of the ticket. And while it's really difficult to take back the House because of gerrymandering, there are a lot of people retiring and opening up competitive seats that Republicans hold that Obama won, like, for example, New York 19, the Hudson Valley, Pennsylvania 8, Minnesota 2, Nevada 4. So there's a bunch of places where there are open seats or one-term Republicans where Democrats have a chance to pick up some seats, though, again, tough to win it back. And the other thing I would mention is state legislatures. Republicans hold an unprecedented number of houses and numbers of legislators across the country. Why that matters, in 2020 we'll have redistricting again, and so who holds the state houses and the legislatures is hugely important for what happens in Congress, and presidential years are the best opportunities for Democrats to win back some of those houses, to flip some houses. So there's a lot that is happening. I would expect all of these races to be very competitive. Now, even though presidential year turnout generally favors Democrats, for a couple reasons. One, there's less enthusiasm by Democrats this year, so turnout in the two caucuses and the one primary so far on the Democratic side have had it's between 20% and 30% drop in turnout. And everything I'm hearing about, you know, for example, the ballots that are being requested in Texas on the Democratic side is that they're at 2012 levels, not 2008 levels. So Democratic turnout is down. Republican turnout is way up. It's hard to know if that's a function of the fact that I did a survey recently where we asked people, what are you hearing about the presidential race? And, you know, the vast majority of Democrats and Republicans are hearing about Trump. So it's hard to know if the Republican enthusiasm is because all the attention is on the Republican primary or if it's something that endures through through November. But if it does, that's obviously a big problem for Democrats. The other piece is that we still have 62% of people saying the country's on the wrong track. Democrats are discouraged, just as Republicans are, about the economy in particular, but also kind of insecurity around the world. But many Democratic base voters feel that this recovery has not lifted their boats, and they're a little bewildered at how we could have had a Democratic president for 8 years in such a weak recovery. So even though presidential turnout years generally benefit Democrats, there are some countervailing, factors, particularly around turnout and enthusiasm, that may dampen Democratic turnout, which makes a lot of these places that are states that Obama won highly competitive, even in the presidential context. I also think the thing that we don't know is what the top of the ticket does for down-ballot races. I believe a Trump-Clinton matchup is helpful in terms of Democratic turnout. Obviously, Hillary Clinton herself has pretty enthusiastic support among minority voters, and I think that has been an attempt on the part of the Sanders campaign to suggest that it's not enthusiastic and strong, but it is, and you'll see that, you know, in South Carolina on Saturday and in a lot of the Super Tuesday states. So I actually think there is a well of some enthusiasm for Hillary Clinton, even though she's very well defined and has negative ratings in the general electorate. But I think Trump also, I think, will create enthusiasm among Democrats for turning out. In particular, if you look at Latino voters tend to be a little bit less about politics, a little less interested. They're much less likely to register to vote than whites and African Americans. But if you look at their level of interest over the fall into the winter, their level of interest in the race has gone up, which I think is probably a function of the racism and xenophobia in the Republican primary contest, particularly as it relates to immigration. So a Trump-Clinton matchup at the top of the ticket, I think, potentially works against some of those issues I just raised around turnout and enthusiasm, and potentially helps, you know, the down-ballot races that I think will be competitive to maybe lean Democratic. On the other hand, you know, a Clinton-Rubio, and note that I keep saying Clinton because I do not believe Bernie Sanders is going to win the Democratic primary, a Clinton-Rubio matchup I think is, you know, potentially harder for Democrats. Even though Rubio has repudiated his work with the Gang of Eight on immigration, I expect him to go right back there in the general election, and I think he has a shot at picking up some Latino support. I also think that potentially some millennial support. I mean, a lot of this depends on how he positions himself for a general election, because he's had to move to the right. He already is very right wing. Right, but it's sort of relative to some other folks on the stage. He seems moderate, but he's not. So, you know, he's going to have to figure out how to, whether it's on social issues, or on issues of race and ethnicity and tolerance and acceptance, on a whole range of different issues where millennials are actually quite progressive, he would have to figure out how to position himself in a general election context. But if he can, and I do think someone of color is better able to do that than someone who's white running on the Republican side, I think that, you know, he makes the top of the ticket more competitive, and as a result, you know, the down ballot, you know, somewhat more challenging for Democrats.
Okay, before we turn to the audience, I'd like to just ask everyone in whatever order, maybe starting with Juan, just one simple question. Is Donald Trump the new Ronald Reagan?
I think David was speaking about this earlier, so I'm going to cede my time to Dr. Yepsen.
Well, I don't think so, because I think Reagan was a candidate of hope. I think FDR was a candidate of hope. The people you mentioned, Perot, William Jennings Bryan, Father Coughlin, Huey Long, these are people who spoke in American politics, who spoke to anger, fear. I think much of what's going on here with the Trump voter is fear. As Anna said, they've been left behind. People are afraid of terrorists. So I think that the formula still works, that a successful candidate for the American presidency has to be have a hopeful message, an uplifting message, one that speaks to the angels of our better nature. And so I don't think that Donald Trump is another Ronald Reagan. I do think he's having an impact, and he will have an impact, as all of these other people we just mentioned have had on American politics. But no, I don't think so.
I also want to just go to the number piece. I completely agree with the optimism piece. And in fact, if you look throughout history, even recent history in polling about what Americans say the most important thing to them, or the person that they actually end up voting for, is the person that they see as the most optimistic, okay? So there is still, in good times and bad, that underlying issue. But the most important reason I think that he's not Ronald Reagan, demographically, is that America looks a lot different today than it did in 1980. So Ronald Reagan did, in many ways, what Donald Trump is doing, which is peeling off white working class voters from Democrats. In 1980, it was on cultural and social issues. You had those so-called, you know, working class Democrats who felt like the Democratic Party was moving too far to the left on those issues, that and they moved over to Ronald Reagan. Today, it's more economic, but it's also cultural. But the number of white working class men in this country is a lot smaller than it was in 1980, and their percent of the electorate is not as significant as it was in 1980. So in 1980, Ronald Reagan carried 56% of the white vote total, and he won by 10 points. Mitt Romney won the white vote by 59%, and he lost by 5 million votes. So just on raw numbers, just the white vote alone, and then you get to white working class, the number of people who have white Americans who had a four-year degree back in the 80s was like 30%. It's now closer to 50% and climbing. So the shrinking percent of the electorate is what Donald Trump is going after. And if you win those voters, even if you turn them out at record numbers, you can't make up for the fact that you're also turning out, to Anna's point, you're likely – you know, every action has an equal and opposite reaction. You're going to turn out more Latino voters against you. You're going to turn out more college-educated voters to vote against Republicans. So for every Western Pennsylvania, upstate New York voter that Trump is able to move from D to R, he's likely to lose a suburban Philadelphia mom who would have voted for a Republican, or would turn out Latino voter in Florida who might not have been interested in this campaign.
Great. Anna? Yes. Well, I think another thing that's different is that we're more polarized, so that there aren't actually lots of Democratic voters who are available to vote Republican and vice versa. So about 90% of Democrats vote for Democrats, about 90% of Republicans vote for Republicans, and there even independent voters who lean towards one party or the other are very reliable voters for that party, so that there's only about 10% of people in this country who are what we think of as pure independents who really don't lean towards either party. So this persuadable or swing vote is quite small. And I think that in 1980, there were just a lot more opportunities for someone with an optimistic vision to win. I just don't think that – I mean, I just don't think that – I just think that there's very few people and very few voters in play. And actually turnout ends up being in some ways more important than persuading people to vote one way or the other.
Yeah, and that's the one thing to look at too. And if I'm just, I'll just make a pitch for my colleague David Wasserman, put this – tool together on 538.com, and it's fun to play with. You can get addicted to it. But basically, it looks at four major ethnic groups, how they voted in 2012, and it allows you to play with that turnout and the percent of the vote that goes to Democrat or Republican. And when you move those numbers, you see which states flip DRR. It's very rough. I'm sure that the, you know, pollster and you look at that and go, oh, my God, you're making some big assumptions. But the point being, what you see at the very first thing you notice is that if you white college-educated voters turn out at almost 80%, at least in this last election they did. White working-class voters turned out more at like 55%. So it's conceivable that Trump is going to turn out a whole bunch of people, not that they're persuadable, but they'd never have been engaged in the process. And that would be important. And that he could actually maybe move them 2-3 points more Republican. Not 50 points, but just 2-3 points. And nothing else changed, moved that turnout up, that would flip the Electoral College. But that's assuming that those other things do not change. And that's the danger in that strategy.
One last point, Elaine, to come back to your initial point about the Republican Party and is this now the party of Trump, is to say that Ronald Reagan was involved with the Republican Party for a long time. I mean, going back to Barry Goldwater and A Time to Choose, and then the fact that he was challenging Ford in the 70s, and then he comes and, you know, I think pushes out another Bush, the Bush of that time, from the nomination to take the 1980 race. But the key point to me is that Reagan, at the time, was defining conservatism in his image. Trump is trying to now just, I think, push aside this argument of, am I conservative enough? It's that instead that he is the voice of people who are disaffected, people who are angry, people who feel arguably betrayed by the Republican elected officials of our time. If you look at what happened to John Boehner in this town, if you look at what continues to happen in terms of Paul Ryan and even Mitch McConnell, I think they live in fear of being primaried by the far right. I don't think Reagan had that trouble. Reagan was defining conservatism in his era.
That is a great point. And off that point, Juan, I get asked a lot about, will there be a brokered convention? And of course, it is always possible that the voters don't decide and someone will go into Cleveland without a first ballot. The interesting question then is, when you have real people who are delegates as opposed to just allocations, will those delegates be Republicans first, or will they be sort of a completely new breed of people who are diehard Donald Trump supporters? And I think that this question of what's happening below this top level in the Republican Party is a sort of a big question. We don't quite know yet until we see who is getting selected as those convention delegates. And of course, they aren't selected yet. Let's start with some questions. Oh boy, we have a lot of questions, and let's work from the back forward. How about the young man over here in the blue and white striped sweater? Yep. There should be somebody with microphones around. Right. Okay, good.
Hi. Thank you. DeMarquin Johnson. I've enjoyed this discussion. Thanks for having it. And I'm interested in your views on polling and how it can become more valuable for campaigns, voters, and yourselves. What are your thoughts on second-choice polling? Do you think that it would have benefited some of the presidential campaigns to know where they could find more voters, who they should try to push out, and where they can strategize there?
Sure. Well, I think there's been a lot of discussion about the polls this year and whether or not they're accurate and whether or not they'll ever be accurate again. And I think there's an important distinction you have to make between polls conducted by the media and reported on by the media and polls that are actually conducted for campaigns. And they are quite different from each other, and their purpose is quite different. And you'll have to take my word for it, but the polling that we do for campaigns tends to be much more accurate because we tend to mostly work from voter lists when we conduct our surveys, and a lot of these media polls don't. They do random digit dial, and somebody answers the phone, and they say, are you a voter? Are you going to vote? And so you have a lot of non-voters in those media polls, which is one of the reasons why they sometimes look pretty wacky and sort of different from outlet to outlet. You also have lots of different methodologies being used in the media polls. So there are IVR polls, which are the automated surveys. You also have a lot of more and more online polls. Those samples have really big problems. Another reason why you're seeing kind of strange results from place to place and lots of volatility. But on the campaign side, we tend to conduct our polls on the phone through landline and cell phones, and we use voter lists, and we actually use people's actual vote history so that we talk to people we know actually voted in the last presidential election, because that's public information. It's on voter lists. So the campaign polling is pretty in-depth and pretty accurate and very strategic. It's the media polling that, in my view, is mostly useless and is there to drive coverage of the race.
Anybody else have a comment on that before we... Okay, right here.
Thanks. I'm Peggy Orchowski. I'm the congressional reporter for the Hispanic Outlook. I'm wondering if this is kind of the end of ethnic politics here, when you see the diversity of the Republicans, but even more, and this is what I'd like you to speak to, the millennials. 40% of Hispanics now are millennial, and they seem to be what you were talking about in general. Are they millennial first or are they Latino first?
We've seen in the Democratic race that young African Americans behave a little differently than older African Americans. Millennials are also the millennial of the Obama era, as some of them aren't millennials anymore. So there's a constantly changing mix. I suppose it's a little of both. I mean, people can't escape their heritage, and nor can they escape their age. So in some ways, they're going to behave maybe differently than their elders. But on the other hand, they still are who they are. And I saw this watching in the Iowa caucuses early, watching Marco Rubio and to a certain extent Ted Cruz. They were aspirational to a lot of younger Republicans. They liked seeing thinking of themselves as being tolerant. The same thing we saw in the Democratic Party in 2008 with Obama, the first African American. I was always struck by how a lily-white state like Iowa helped elevate Barack Obama, the first African American president, in 2008. And in this cycle, the Republican electorate in that state helped to elevate two Latinos in Cruz and Rubio.
I just wanted to jump in there and say that in Nevada, you might remember that Trump said he won the Latino vote. But once you dive down, you realize it was, I think, 8%, right? And if you then ask the question about the universe of Latinos in the state, well, gee whiz, I think it's 85%+ are Democrat, mm-hmm. right? So we're talking about a small group of a small group. And overall, what you see among Latinos in this time of strong anti-immigrant fervor in the Republican ranks is a movement away from identifying as Republicans. When Reince Priebus, the chair of the Republican National Committee, did his autopsy after the 12 election, he talked about the need for greater outreach and in specific to the Latino community because of potentially shared values with regard to family, business, entrepreneurship, and the like. I think that the strong anti-immigrant refrain has essentially nullified all of those efforts, and especially in the person in the campaign of Donald Trump, which right out the door said, so many of these Mexicans immigrants are rapists and thieves and the like. But to me, it comes back to almost a personal core issue, which is that even as you see higher rates of intermarriage for Latinos than you would for blacks, and therefore you see greater emphasis on assimilation and, again, greater potential for someone to say, oh, that's another white person, not a Latino or Hispanic. You certainly could say that about Cruz and Rubio. It's also the case that people will say, that's my grandmother you're talking about that you want to deport. That's my family that you want to break apart. That becomes very personal, and I think, no pun intended, that trumps the instinct that millennials might have to say, well, you know, I identify with this other struggle.
Let's see, right here, right here.
I'm Dana Milbank. I'm president of the David Yepsen Fan Club. This Anna Greenberg, with whom I'm not familiar, takes a very dim view of the media and says that we've been complicit in the rise of Trump and we use a lot of lousy polling. So I wanted to ask the others on the panel for their view and how they would grade the media in this cycle. I particularly wonder if Juan wants to be so bold as to venture how his outlet has covered it and how you all view the others.
Sure. Why not? I step in it all the time. I was interested in listening because I think that was a Gallup last time, Anna, that just, you know, had a terrible goal. Terrible goal. In fact, say that they no longer will do this kind of polling because they had such a terrible goal. Well, they are not a media outlet, right? I don't know, but you're talking about polling that's done for the candidates. Is that what you're saying?
I'm talking, there's two categories. There are polls that are commissioned directly by media outlets. So Fox commissions its own research, et cetera. And then there are the institutions like Quinnipiac and PPP that push out poll after poll after poll, which are breathlessly reported on without any questions about the source of the sample. Are you actually talking to primary voters? So both those kinds of polls are kind of, you know, I think sort of all over the place in every outlet. So.
Well, I agree with you, and I think, like, Rush Limbaugh will have, you know, here we are. But I'm saying, to my mind, I think that it's in the question. So to the president of the Anna Greenberg fan, oh, is it David Jepsen fan? I would say, sir, that people ask questions from points of view, and I know at Fox, there you will see questions that, to my mind, are more to the point and from a perspective that you would identify as conservative. And therefore, you get certain responses. Recently, I'm blocking on this, so maybe someone can help. But there was a question, and it got very different responses based on the question. The way the question was worded is what I'm trying to say. And people were confused by this, but again, I think that's a reflection of an era of niche media in the American marketplace and then how it plays down in terms of polling.
I am definitely not going to defend the media's handling of Trump, and I think much of it has been, what's the word, irresponsible and ridiculous. And I think that the rush for clicks and eyeballs has been a big part of this. At the same time, again, this isn't new, okay? Guess what? Again, campaigns. Guess what? The media likes to cover controversy. Guess what? The media likes stardom. Guess what? The media will take whatever little shiny object you put in front of them. Guess who manipulated that brilliantly? Donald Trump. So the media would start with a, oh, my God, can you believe this Muslim thing? Oh, that's crazy. Let's ask all his opponents how they feel about the Muslim thing. So we talk about that for a second, and then Donald Trump's like, actually, I don't want to talk about that anymore. Let's talk about something else crazy. And then we all ran over to cover that crazy. Instead of the candidate saying, you know what, I'm not going to talk about that. You know what I'm going to talk about? Let's go one more. Let's make Donald Trump answer about his taxes. Answer your taxes. Just go over and over and over. They could have manipulated it too. There was so much stuff out there. Oh, Donald Trump, you wanted me to answer Muslims? Fine. This is how I answer Muslims. I'd like Donald Trump to answer for this. Then put that into the media stream. The media would have eaten it up like a minute. Great, let's ask Trump more questions. Yay! Instead, there was this passiveness like, well, certainly his mocking people, that's going to catch up with him. No, because then he just changed the subject. Do you really believe this? I don't know. I don't know what I was thinking. I'm going to – somebody called it – who was I talking to recently? It's called the dead cat theory, right? Like if you are in a conversation and we're talking about something and somebody throws a dead cat in the middle of the table, that's what you're going to be talking about, is the dead cat. You're not going to talk about whatever else anybody wants to talk about. And Trump just kept throwing that dead cat in there. We all kept talking about it.
Yeah, David?
Just real quickly, I think one of the things that hasn't been mentioned here in the media business, and certainly that's where I come from, is reporters make news judgments about who's viable and who isn't. When you have who's going to go somewhere, if someone looks like they might be president, they're given more scrutiny. Early on, most media people dismissed this Trump thing. This guy isn't going anywhere. He can't be president. I mean, he's a great celebrity, but we're going to focus our attention on candidates who might be going somewhere. And so, for example, you saw a lot of early scrutiny of Scott Walker, and he started being vetted as a serious presidential candidate. That process, I don't think, went on as much with Donald Trump. The media narrative has gone from Trump's this kook, he can't possibly win, to, oh, my God, he's inevitable. And at no point in this has there been that normal vetting of his position on issues that as a scrutiny that has gone to other candidates.
Let's see, the lady right here, the red hair, right, where's our microphone? Yeah.
Sorry, thank you very much. I'd like to ask about the role of big money and PAC money and the evolution of PACs based on different kinds of reporting. In particular, the sort of Karl Rove, Adelson names out there, kind of money going into paid advertising doesn't seem to have worked very well. But there are also reports that in Iowa and other places, increasingly PACs have become sort of parallel campaigns doing data mining and door knocking and blah, blah, blahing. So I'd like to ask about the role of big money and how it's evolving from what you've seen so far.
Well, I agree. It's actually been kind of encouraging to me to see we were all fearful that, oh, my gosh, Citizens United, we're just going to be awash in money. What will be the effect of that? And boy, there's sure been a lot of it that was just wasted because it was turned into TV ads, wallpapered these primary states, and a lot of it didn't have effect. What was almost encouraging to me is some of the most effective money was spent on what? Shoe leather. Using data mining techniques, finding out likely voters, and sending a human being out to actually see another human being and say, will you think about this candidate or will you vote for this person? That seems to have had some effect. But the overwhelming amount of money has not had the impact that I thought it would.
I think on the big money issue, the presidential election is a little bit irrelevant because the amount of attention presidential candidates get rivals anything that they can get from paid ads. I think we have to look below the level of president, and that's where it's much more insidious. Certainly Senate, gubernatorial, congressional, but also and also now recently the state legislative level, and they mostly carry the negative. And they sort of do that job for campaigns so they can carry the positive and the IEs can carry the negative. But it's also the case that they're, and David alluded to this, they're building a sort of field operation funded by the Kochs that could rival what labor unions do. They're investing, I think, something like $50 million in building a field program that'll be the shoe lever, the door knocks, the phone calls, which is something that they have not really done before. Traditionally, Democrats are much better at the field, the get-out-the-vote operation. So it's encouraging that at the presidential level it seems to have no impact. What's less encouraging is it has a big impact below the presidential level. And, of course, Republicans outspend Democrats significantly on the independent side. So when I was talking earlier about what these down-ballot races look like, another challenge for Democrats is that below the level of president, get massively outspent.
And let me just say one of the things we've seen this year is the Democratic bench is not very deep. We just don't have the sort of numbers of people even to that could be president. We don't have a lot of governors, et cetera. And I think that's an issue of some concern. We are, unfortunately, I know this has been a great, there's lots of interest here because we've got this terrific panel who knows an amazing amount. But we are at the end of our time. So I want to thank Anna and David and Amy and Juan for a terrific panel.